This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Oh, surprise, surprise, another Republican politician caught up in a lie. Or another politician. Kristi Noem back in the news again. As if, you know, shooting her dog in the face wasn't bad enough with the new book. And look, they always say you need new publicity. You need something, a hook to get people to buy your book. Well, redaction. Hurry up and get the first edition, because evidently they're going to be taking out some of the lies, the half-truths, the obfuscations, the stuff that probably made the book worth reading, but weren't, well, true. Because we find out that the story about staring down Kim Jong-un, it didn't happen. And it's one of those things where you go, did she lie and think, you know, nobody was going to read the book anyway, so she'd get away with it? Did she meet an Asian at the airport and go, hey, that looks like Kim Jong-un, and give him the stare down? Or more likely, you know, did she not even read what her ghostwriter wrote? And that's probably it. Or did she and didn't care? And the thing that gets me is, you know, this is what we've come to expect from politicians. This is what we've come to expect, especially from Republicans. In the Trump era, what this generation of Republicans, you know, who used to be the law and order crowd, who used to be the honesty people, personal responsibility folk, now it's the spaghetti theory. Throw a bunch of you-know-what against the walls and hope nobody pays attention after you have to go, well, that wasn't really true. I guess it's the world we're in. I guess we're inundated with so much that, you know, that idea of no, you know, there's no such thing as bad press. We'll see. This may endure her to Donald Trump. This may be her key into being the VP choice, since there's no low. There's no low. And I look at this and I go, it's us. You know, it's what we've come to expect. It's what we've rewarded over the years. So am I surprised? No. And look, I blame our news media for a lot of this, because, hey, we feed into it. You know, I was reading this interview over at Semaphore, and they were talking to the executive editor of the New York Times, is Joe Kahn. And in it, he says, look, you know, don't blame us. You know, we're just giving the people what they want. You know, we're not talking about saving democracy or high-minded stuff. You know, people just, they want what they hear. They want what they want. You know, the old Kink song, you know, give the people what they want. And I don't know that I agree with that when you're talking about the news media, with our news meter. Because, I don't know, should editors use polling to give people what they want? Or should they be giving us what we need, information about, you know, what's going on? You know, like an all-out frontal assault on democracy. Should we have a media culture that informs us of what's going on instead of just what seems popular, what the pollsters who rig these polls to get the responses that they want feed them? And I've always said about our corporate-controlled mainstream media, they're going to bend to the moneyed interests, because that's who pays their salaries, and they're going to bend toward, well, not having to do much work. Because there are few of them, they're overworked, underpaid, and if you make it easy for them by going, hey, there's a poll, we're going to give people what they want and reinforce the narrative already out there. So am I surprised? No, not at all. Am I surprised our media doesn't give us what we need? No, because it's a for-profit industry. And, you know, you look at the fact that, you know, right now inflation is and immigration are the two issues that they're focused on. Because, again, the narrative from the right is, you know, we've never seen such inflation. And, you know, these protests on college campuses, we've never seen such a thing. And you go, yeah, it was your grandparents and parents' generation who saw all that. We've got people alive who remember much worse things on college campuses and much worse inflation. I had someone the other day tell me, we have never had higher mortgage rates than we have right now. Really? I actually know someone. You know, they're still alive. Their mortgage rates were upwards of 18% back in the late 70s, which is a bit higher than where we are now. But it's this sensationalism that we get from our media structure. It's the clickbaiting that we need. You know, I happened to be reading a story about a kid in Minneapolis, worked at a Dairy Queen, 20-year-old kid, you know, assistant manager of this Dairy Queen. It sees a blind guy drop a $20 bill on the ground. Sees a woman pick it up, stuff it in her purse. He says, look, give it back or we're not going to serve you. And ultimately threw the woman out. And I got to tell you, as I was reading through the story, my mind kept going to the place where I fear it's going to go. You know, that he's going to get fired for doing what all of us think is the right thing, telling this woman to hit the bricks. But no, this story was better. This story said, look, the kid reached into his pocket, gave the blind person, you know, the 20 bucks and made them whole. Took it on himself to be a decent person. I know that's not what we, the people, want to hear, but those are stories we need. We need to reward. But instead, you get little snots like the kid at Ole Miss who was making monkey noises at a black woman during a recent protest and how, you know, how he got thrown out of his fraternity. And that's justice. No, it's not justice. I guarantee every one of those kids in that fraternity were doing the same thing. When I was a kid, that would have happened. There would have been repercussion. Somebody would have popped him right between the eyes. But we don't do much of that anymore. We don't hold people accountable. And that's a problem with our media as well as with us. You know what I'd like to hear from my media? I'd like to hear that we're going after the corporate criminals who are robbing us blind. I'd like to hear how workers are getting screwed in the workplace. I would like to know how we save our democracy. But instead, what we're told is we're just giving the people what they want. And evidently, what we want is a steady diet of people behaving horribly and of division and things to make us angry and pitted against each other. Maybe, evidently, that is what we're looking for. Not information on how we salvage democracy, how we hand off a country better to our children than we found. So I got to tell you, I'm a little frustrated with our news media, but not surprised. There is a for-profit motive, and it runs right through the people who pay their paychecks. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Will Bunch is going to be here to share some thoughts on the assaults on protests. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So recently, EU investigators raided Dutch and Polish offices of security scanner maker Nuketech, a case reportedly that hinges on China's massive subsidies to their firms, which undercut European companies. So the question becomes, is this a move that is the beginning of the EU finally standing up to itself? For itself against mercantilist China and the trade practices, or is this just a show? And here to share some thoughts on where this is and maybe how it affects us, I've asked our friend Emily De La Bruyere to come talk with us. She's the co-founder of Horizon Advisory, their website, horizonadvisory.org. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
It's awesome to be here. Thank you.
So is this rating, is this something we should be paying attention to? Because I know there's been a lot of lip service over the years coming out of the EU. We got to stand up to China. We can't keep them letting them steamroller over us. Is this a big deal or not?
There's this constant up and down in Europe's response to China, which is the ultimate ping pong game. And the problem is right now, there are just also so many indicators of Europe trying to play nice with China. And it's tough because they know that what Beijing is doing is wrong and is against their interests, at least trade-wise. And Europe, like, gets trade policy better actually than the U.S. does, but they're not willing to do anything assertive about it. So you'll get these raids, but at the same time, every major European leader is out there meeting with Xi Jinping.
Yeah, and look, because people want the cheap stuff. I mean, ultimately, it's that drug that we've been, for a couple of decades now hooked on. We want cheap stuff. It's the Walmart, cheap stuff through better living through cheap stuff. And you go, no, it's actually worse living because, we don't have jobs.
Yeah, they want cheap stuff. And especially in Europe's case, they want the Chinese market. Like every major European company out there, like the Airbuses of the world, they want to sell into China. And they have strong relations and a lot of influence over their national governments. And so they're out there saying, hey, no, we got to play nice. Let's have close ties. And the combination of those two things, like the economic benefit of goods from China and this push for the Chinese market, even for companies that are never going to get the Chinese market because right, that's going to Chinese companies, that's enough to keep Europe playing ball.
No, this is, look, I've been arguing this for years because as you were talking about access to Chinese markets, I remember GM built like a $2 billion production facility there in hopes that they would be able to sell those vehicles there. And sadly, a lot of those came back here, early 2000s. And I remember knowing, talking to GM workers who at the time were fighting against this because they knew we're not getting access to that market. And if we do, there aren't a lot of people who are going to be able to buy the products that we make. So it seems like kind of a fool's errand.
Yes. And it's happened time and time again. And the story is always that an international company goes in and maybe they get to sell into the Chinese market for some period of time, but they had to go in partnership with a Chinese company. Oh, wait, now that Chinese company has the same capabilities, the same product as the international one, and the international company is forced out. And then not only do they lose the Chinese market because of that, but the new Chinese champion with state subsidies and having cheaply acquired whatever crown jewel technology the foreign company had goes out and captures its global market.
Yeah, or captures everything, the company entirely and grabs that name. I mean, as consumers, I've heard this argument thousands of times. Well, I just want to have the choice. We should give American consumers the choice of buying a Chinese product that's a little bit cheaper, an American-made product is a little bit more. But in most cases, I don't have that choice because there aren't that competition seems to already have been killed off in a lot of industries.
Yeah, because that's an idea of free, fair competition that China doesn't want. And so if one side is looking for that, which is effectively cooperation, and the other side is looking just to, as you said, steamroll, then, oh, wait, we're going to end up with only the Chinese good.
Now, you know, the argument that, you know, people have made, well, we need this for diplomacy. We're going to undo all of these years of working together. And I'm going, I don't think we were working together. I think we were getting taken. I think we were getting taken to the cleaners.
Yeah, we weren't working together. And also, we haven't been reaping the benefits of a free trade system. That's the other line I get. Oh, wait, if we compete with China now, that's going to be super inflationist. It's going to bring about all this protectionism. And we're going to do away with all the economic rewards of decades of free trade. It's like, no, what are you thinking? There hasn't been free trade. It's been China distorting markets this whole time. And any benefit we've gotten has been artificial and short term, and we're losing.
Artificial and short-term. Short-term being the key to this. Because, yeah, we got a lot of cheap stuff early on. I don't know if you've noticed. I hear people complaining all over the place of how things aren't cheap anymore.
Yeah, and also, the cost of a good, its price is relative to how much resources the person buying it has. And our resources as a population, as a country, are going down the more China takes our jobs and our productive capacity and our potential for economic growth. So even if Beijing is giving us cheap goods, we're paying for those out of a total pie or a total budget or a wallet that's shrinking because of what China's doing.
You know, I hear what you're saying, and I know there are people out there going, well, that's protectionism. And I say all the time, yeah, I'm a protectionist. When I leave my house, I lock the door. I'm not an isolationist. I don't have a giant moat around my house. So I think we should be protecting ourselves against people who are going to cheat, against people who are going to manipulate the market in a way that benefits them and harms us. But what do you say to the person who goes, well, you know, or what do you say to my argument? If we're dumb enough to let them do it, they're dumb enough to do it.
Let's stop letting them do it.
Exactly. When all of the intellectual property theft was going on, the line that I kept that I had for years, because we haven't heard a lot about that over the last couple of years, but it was hot and heavy for a while, about 10 years ago. Oh, intellectual property theft. You know, they're stealing all this stuff. That was the thing. And I would go, so you went there. If U.S. corporations are dumb enough to go there, give a majority of their control of their interest to a Chinese company and then get ripped off, that's their problem. They did this. There's a country that protects your property rights, and you left it.
Yeah, and at the same time, we need companies because we need to be making things. We need to have an economy. And, you know, so like, American companies sold us out 100%. But at the same time, we need industry.
Right. I agree.
And, like, I'll take Prodigal Son. Like, I'll take them back. If they can figure this out and be on the right side, 100%, no problem. But they need to figure it out. And it's just crazy, too, because you have so many companies that have started saying the right thing. And it's a question I get all the time is, okay, but like Apple is talking about how they need a secure supply chain and they're moving out of China. So isn't like Main Street USA moving in the right direction? But then if you actually look at their resource allocations, they're still investing in China.
Yeah. Or in their stockholders. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Apple story. What is it? $110 billion in stock buybacks are going to happen in addition to the $100 billion they took 2018? So again, money where your mouth is, they're putting it into rich people's pockets and not into the products that they're talking about. I agree with you.
And then, of course, there's the Europe question too, which is like, if we're bad, the U.S. is still farther ahead on all of these things than our allies are. And that's the striking thing, is every time it's like we haven't done enough or our companies haven't done enough, odds are that European or other allied countries and companies have done even less.
And is a part of that because the EU and you know, and China have done a whole bunch of infrastructure things together? There's this, what would they call it, the Belt and Rust plan that they have?
Belt and Road, yeah.
Yeah, the Belt and Road.
I like Belt and Rust. I'm going to go with that one.
Yeah, no, I mean, the idea that they're buying, you know, that they're basically buying their way in and then controlling all of that. It's like an invasive species that gets a hold of one of your trees, like I got out back. It just kills it.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. And China's, you know, sees the opportunity, especially of European, the reality that European economies are less strong. right? And so China's come in and said, okay, we're here for you. We'll help you out. There's also the fact that Europe resents the US. And I feel like this is a truth that just like hasn't been fully absorbed by at least US policymakers who are like, those are our strongest allies. Europe really resents America. And they resent the whole, you know, unipolar US system that Europe has played junior partner to the US and the world. And they've felt controlled and like they've had their autonomy undermined over the past decades. And of course, there's a lot going on there. Like the US has provided its allies with a lot, and that should be accounted for too. But China's really taken advantage of that and said, okay, Europe, you resent the US, we're an alternative.
Yeah.
And we're part of a multipolar world order, which is what you want too. We can all be friends.
Yeah, it's the thing I talked about during the Trump years, as Trump moved away from the international community and supporting allies in, you know, other regions of the world, China was more than happy to step in with investments. And in 2010, when everyone's screaming about, we shouldn't be giving foreign aid, China was more than happy to fill in those voids.
Yeah, and China's really good at seizing on and manipulating any resentment or tension or friction between the U.S. and either its partners internationally or even its population.
But, you know, looking at this and that the EU did this and that there's real serious talk of pushing back, do you see a possibility where maybe some of those resentments with the U.S., you know, are tapped down, or maybe the globe finally wakes up and goes, this isn't what we signed up for? I think the motto that they're using is, you know, like something like competition and not dumping or something like that. You know, do you think this pulls us together at all?
I mean, the trend lines are definitely there. Like the narrative coming out of Europe now is so different and so much better on China than 5 years ago. Like they realize that Beijing is not a good actor. The problem is the same way it is for us domestically. It's fits and starts. You see one sign of progress like this raid on nuke tech, but then I promise you when Xi Jinping goes to France in a couple months, they're going to sign a host of economic agreements. And like you had Italy, they pulled out of the Belt and Road, but now Italy's leadership, Belt and Rust, sorry, I should correct myself. I love that. But now Italy's leadership is like, oh, actually, we want to be friends with China. We're going there this summer. Like it's the two steps forward or the one step forward situation. So the trend line is there and they're waking up, but there's not that much time to get it right.
Now, is this at a leadership level, or do you think when it filters down to people, they get it? I talk to people all the time, and their sense is we want U.S. manufacturing. We want to build things here. We don't want, you know, China coming in and taking over things. But I look at this TikTok thing, and I'm kind of just I don't know that we get it as a society as much as I'd like to believe.
I think that on the Europe front, there is a messaging problem on the US end where both people and leaders in Europe, even if they recognize China's threat, they think that there's a difference between the threat China poses to them and the threat China poses to the US. And so they stop short of a certain point because they say, that's America's problem. We don't care about the great power competition. We just care about, you know, trade rules or human rights or whatever. And they don't realize that like in China's front, you can't disentangle those. And the threat is all there. So I think that's a big problem. And part of that, and a lot of the Europe question is on the US to be better at messaging and leveraging our influence and leveraging our power to bring our allies to where they have to be.
Have we done any, look, I know Trump, you know, put the trade barriers up, some tariffs, didn't have much of a follow-up game to that. And I know Biden has kept those. Are we, in your estimation, you know, doing what you do, are we moving in a better direction? Clearly, there's always more that can and should be done, but are we at least moving in a better direction?
Sure. Yes, sure. Maybe. But it's so slow, right? It doesn't keep up. The problem is it doesn't keep up with China's power.
Right. No, but here's the thing. If you were to wave a magic wand and go, we're going to fix all this stuff, wouldn't it cause, you know, massive disruptions? I mean, if you're the leaders of these countries, you got to know when prices go up, people are going to lose their mind. You know, kind of look around at prices have gone up. People are losing their minds, only they're looking at the wrong people in most parts. But it's going to cause some kind of disruption. And I don't think leaders are really leaders and want that.
Exactly, because also they're probably going to lose their elections. And it's a sad situation, but I don't think today's slate of leaders is able to say our election is less important than the future of our country.
That speaks volumes to where we are. But, you know, I know someone will say, well, you know, have we ever had those kind of leaders? And I'm sure we have. But with today's social media and the kind of instant propaganda that we see coming out of, I don't know, something like TikTok, I see the forces being a little bit greater than they've ever been.
Exactly. And there isn't the cushion, right? Like, you used to be able to do something and then there was at least some time or some time to message it or for the effects to show. And now it's right there. And not only is it immediately there for the population to seize on, but it's also immediately there for the US adversary to seize on, as you pointed out with TikTok. But at a certain point, the leader has to decide that they don't care and they're still going to do the right thing and they're going to step up. And honestly, maybe the American population is going to respect that, because that's what a leader should do.
No, and the hope is that they do it before it's too late, because it's not too late. I mean, as I've been looking at some stuff, we've been trending somewhat downward on the amount of stuff that comes in from China, just not at a pace I think that really is fast enough that's going to help us long term.
Yeah. And the problem with those numbers too is in many cases that they miss the China sending goods to the US through other parties. Like, what's the China-Mexico trade and then Mexico-US trade, and how have those volumes changed when it looks like China's going down?
No, that's an excellent point. But, you know, as we're looking at new technologies, as we're looking at, you know, automobile production and, you know, wind turbines and all this stuff, I keep saying I'd like us to be at the front of that. I'd like those to be the jobs my children and grandchildren get, instead of losing those entire industries, as sadly we have done over the past 20, 30 years, to where every advancement forward seems to be those jobs being outsourced and our billionaire class reaping the benefits.
And that is where there's an optimistic story. There's a whole new industrial revolution happening. So we do have the chance to kind of, it's not even catch up, but like to start fresh in, for example, new energy industries. The issue is that right now China controls those entire industries.
Thanks for making me happier. So last question I've got for you. What should people do? What should I do? What should we be doing? Obviously, this is a messaging thing. Obviously, this is a political issue, because bad policies and bad ideas got us here. How do we get out of it?
Well, it's partly our consumption, right? Like, we have a voice with what we buy and what we use. And buying things made in America, and actually made in America, is a part of it. But also, like, it's an election year. And making this the number one issue, or a number one issue, that goes a long way. Because every politician currently running for election should think that they have to have a good track record on China if they're going to get reelected.
Yeah. No, if we can get more Sherrod Browns, I'd be thrilled with that. More Bob Caseys, I'd be thrilled with that. But Emily, I appreciate the thoughts and the time. As always, great stuff.
Thank you. Great chatting.
Our good friend Emily de la Bruyere. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Also, make sure you check out her website at horizonadvisory.org. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the last couple of weeks, we've been watching the protests on college campuses across the country. And it's been interesting to watch the news and some of the coverage. Now, I haven't jumped in the middle of all this. I haven't gotten into the whole debate one side or the other. But when you start bulldozing campuses and you start taking away people's ability to come together and peacefully protest, kind of got a problem with that. That's why I've asked my good friend Will Bunch to come talk with us. He's got a new piece out talking about this very issue. He's a columnist over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, hey, Rick, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
So, you know, look, I've deliberately stayed away from all of this because, you know, the old Buffalo Springfield song, you know, nobody's right if everybody's wrong. And that's I look right at all sides of what's going on over there and go, you know, it's all wrong. I agree that the killing should stop. I don't want children dying. But when you come back here and you see the kind of chaos and the kind of things that have been going on, I got to tell you, I'm siding with the people who are doing what Americans are able to do, and that is peacefully protest.
Right. And that's what, you know, and I have written, you know, not exclusively and not even a majority, but I've written some columns since October 7th. And, you know, I've certainly raised some questions over that time during, you know, obviously I objected to October 7th but since then I've raised questions about Israel's conduct of its attacks on Gaza. But I think your introduction is spot on in that what we're talking about now, these last 2 weeks, really transcends that, because it really gets into, what free speech rights do Americans have, whether they're young people on college campuses or anywhere. You know, it's been really shocking to see how many college presidents have right away, you know, as soon as some of these, a few kids have, you know, put up a few tents on the main lawn and have done nothing beyond that, that's like threatening or violent, you know, have called in riot cops basically, you know, and you know, every situation has its own nuances, obviously, you know, in some of these red states like Texas, the University of Texas, or in Georgia, we have Emory University, you know, you've got these right-wing red state governors who are really eager to prove their bona fides, right? You know, to show how tough they can be on the protesters. And, you know, in Austin at the University of Texas, I mean, students basically just said, we're going to have a protest today about Gaza. And Greg Abbott had the state troopers there instantaneously. You know, it's like they hadn't even done it. You know, and he said, well, you know, we're fighting anti-Semitism. Well, they hadn't said anything yet. You know, he didn't even wait to hear what they're going to say. And then the other question is, you know, should people be met with riot cops for what they say? You know, when does it cross the line? You know, I mean, it's complicated, right? Because I mean, civil disobedience, certain forms of civil disobedience, you go into it figuring either you could be arrested or in some cases definitely expecting to be arrested, right? So like when you, as opposed to setting up tents, if you take over a college building like these kids at Columbia did, you know, you can expect at some point if you don't leave.
And I support that. You find the door. Look, we're not catering. You're taking over a building. That's never going to happen. But, you know, in public space.
But even there, I mean, the response, you know, Rick, was so militarized, you know. I mean, if you look at that situation at Columbia.
Hold on, Will. You know, I've spent a lot of time, you know, studying the history of labor and the sit-down strikes of the 30s. Those guys were met with baseball bats and clubs and beaten senseless. So I'm going to look at this a little differently probably than you are. They shouldn't have taken over the building. They should have gone when they were supposed to. Look, there's a place on public space to protest, in my view.
Yeah, right. That they should be. I was just going to say that there were certain aspects to that police response that, even if it was maybe appropriate to arrest the takeover students, you know, the size of the police force, you know, the fact that they used the event to issue a kind of a propaganda film afterwards. But I think that's not the crux. I mean, the crux is of what's really wrong is if you look at places like yesterday, for example, Saturday at the University of Virginia, you had a small group of very peaceful protesters. And again, you know, you've got a Republican governor there and they're sending in state troopers. And within a short period of time, they're firing tear gas, you know, they're spraying pepper spray at kids. And, you know, is this really the appropriate response? And I think, you know, I think this whole, what we've seen the last 2 weeks has really kind of brought some clarity to some problems that have been going on for a long time. I mean, one is just, you know, the over-militarization of our police. And this is something we've been talking about for the last 20 years, but it really was apparent, I think, in this response. But the other thing is, it really raises some questions about the way our universities are governed. You know, a lot of critics say that too many modern universities act like they're hedge funds and maybe real estate management companies, and they have this academic thing going on the side. You know, it was clear that a lot of these college presidents were looking to achieve three things. One is, you know, get their kind of McCarthyite Republican critics in Congress off their back, you know, because Republicans are trying to make as much political hay out of this as possible. Two, they're trying to appease, you know, their wealthiest donors and trustees who don't like protests, maybe partly on this issue, but also because protests have a way of turning against the things that matter to billionaires, you know, and they'd probably like to see it go away. And the third thing is these cowardly college presidents want to keep their jobs. I mean, what's a better high paying gig in this country than being a college president? And what it does when they, you know, instantly call the police on campus to break these things up, you know, they're disrespecting the traditions of faculty governance. You know, I mean, you know, colleges are supposed to be open institutions. You know, the faculty is supposed to have an enormous amount of power over what goes on at the university. Of course, I mean, clearly that's not true anymore.
What's interesting to me, though, Will, is, you know, a lot of the people who are the ones who are the biggest opponents are the ones who are on those college campuses back in the 60s.
Yeah, I know. It's just infuriating. And it just goes to show, you know, I'm sure a lot of people who, were flirted with socialism or communism or were protesters in the 30s were against the Vietnam protesters in the late 60s. You know, I mean, it's like the circle of life, right, to some degree. And, you know, I mean, while protest and dissent, it's this great tradition in America, but when it happens in real time, you know, the grownups are worried, certainly particularly older, you know, Democratic voters in the 45 plus age bracket, you know, are terrified of how these protests are going to affect Joe Biden, you know, and whether
I'm one of them.
Yeah. Well, and it's understandable. I mean, look, we know the history, right? We know that in 1968, when you had a lot of protests and you had protests at Columbia, and in August of that year, you had the huge protests at the Democratic National Convention, which we may or may not be on track to repeat.
I'm expecting it in 2024.
Yeah. And we know that that put the Democrats in a huge hole. You know, Hubert Humphrey, who was the labor-backed candidate, right, tried to make it up all fall. He came within 1 point of Richard Nixon, and Nixon was the law and order candidate. I mean, he ran ads showing campus protests and saying, you know, we can't have disorder in this country, and Nixon won, and you know, we put the Chicago Seven on trial. You know, he started, you know, bugging and spying on people, which eventually led to Watergate. And, you know, that was the fallout from protests in 1968. So it's kind of crazy to think it's not going to happen on some level again.
But here's the thing, Will, and this is where my mind goes, because, look, as I said, you know, I'm kind of in the middle. I understand all sides of this, but I believe wholeheartedly in the right to peacefully protest and to have your voices heard. My problem is it's unequally administered. You know, as I was talking to my Red Hat friends, and I said, you know, how many times have you seen the Hitler Youth walking down the center of town? I've never seen a cop beat the Hitler Youth. The Patriot Force or the Proud Boys or any of them have their rallies, have their marches, do their thing. We don't see bulldozers.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. You know, I mean, you know, call me crazy, Rick, but it's almost like the police sympathize with these right-wing protesters.
Wait, but here's the part of this, Will, and yeah, I think you know, you hit on it earlier. You know, we've got to control the stuff, and I agree the police may be a little bit, but they're just the tool in all this. They're the one, they're being unleashed, knowing what they're going to do on these. It's the people who made the decision to send them in that I got a problem with.
Yeah, exactly. And it, you know, it seems like certain types of quote disorder unquote just will not be tolerated, and other kinds it seems like are tolerated. I mean, yeah.
And for me, you know, it comes
I mean, look, the police in D.C. knew about January 6th for weeks, and all they had up were those flimsy metal barricades.
Right.
Now, if the you know, the Coalition to Free Palestine had said 6 weeks in advance they were going to bring 10,000 people to Washington, you can bet there would be more than just those metal barricades would have been put up.
No, you're right. But, you know, for me as a labor person, when I look at this again, yeah. You know, when I see people who are working to realize that they have power and they have power in numbers, this is when I think you see this coming down hard on people. And you said it a minute ago, you know, that the billionaires and the rich people who fund those very wealthy endowments at these universities, when they get uncomfortable, it's when working people and when people realize that they have power and start demanding changes, and this could morph into something else. And that's what they want to nip in the bud, in my view.
Absolutely. And you know, there's kind of an interesting confluence between, you know, that history of anti-labor, you know, police violence and what happens on college campuses. Because if you remember in the 1960s, back when public universities were affordable, you know, I mean, some of them were free, right? The University of California, yeah. And other colleges cost $200 a month. And, you know, in that whole post-World War II generation, you had lots of children of union workers, lots of kids of the working class were first-generation college students. And the fact that these kids were, you know, according to the right, according to people like Ronald Reagan, they were being indoctrinated and, you know, turned against the establishment, and that just couldn't be tolerated. You know, there was an advisor to Ronald Reagan named Roger Freeman, who in 1970, you know, the year of the Kent State massacres and other protests, said, you know, we can't have an educated proletariat. That would be dynamite. You know, he said that on the record, you know, and so, yeah, certain kinds of things that they determine as threats to the social order. I mean, organized labor is always going to be one of those threats. But likewise, when young people adopt certain causes, whether it's anti-war, if it's pro-civil rights, or young people with college education becoming pro-labor, which some of them are, all of those things now make college students a threat, it seems like.
So last line of questioning I got for you, because the other part of this, you said that, you know, it's bad. Yeah, it is bad. But, you know, in several months, we've got an election, could get worse.
Yeah, I mean the column, I appreciate you mentioning my most recent column I wrote today. And actually, I mean, that was kind of the point, to say that people are right to be, the people who are angry and frustrated at the system right now have a right to be, you know. You know, these over-the-top police responses shouldn't be happening. You know, these universities have been exposed as problematic in a lot of cases. You know, all of it shows that we have a lot of problems right now at this moment in 2024. But there's also no question that a lot of things, including the things that would matter to students who are out protesting, would materially get worse if Donald Trump gets elected in November. I mean, whatever you think of the crackdown on protests now, I mean, you know, Trump has talked openly about using the Insurrection Act, calling out troops, sending National Guards into cities and onto college campuses. You know, he would do those things. I mean, again, we're not going to get into the weeds on the Middle East, but trust me, his Israel-Palestine policies would be worse than anything you're seeing right now.
For me, the other side of this is it's not just this. It's what's next. It's, you know, what if it's an issue that you're concerned about? What if you want to protest something? What happens to you then? And then we just go, well, you know, that's just how it is now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, remember the first time Trump was elected and inaugurated, you had the massive women's march took place on January 21st, the day after his inauguration. I mean, would he allow that this time around? I mean, we don't really know. You know, would he see something like the women's march, you know, and something that was, you know, pro reproductive rights and dealt with those other issues? Would he see that as something threatening enough that, you know, he would call up, you know, you'd have, you know, all these women in pink hats on one side and you'd have tanks on the other side. I mean, I really have those. I mean, they've said so much on the record. It's not paranoid to have those kind of concerns about a second Trump presidency.
No, you are spot on there. Will, as always, great stuff. Hope folks will take a look at the opinion piece over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Like Attila the Hun, Trump is poised to ransack a moral decadent U.S. empire. Will, as always, great stuff, man.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Our good friend Will Bunch. Again, make sure you check out the work that he does. We'll get links out on social media. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you concerned about this? Or you go, look, this is a good idea. We should be cracking down on all protests, especially yours. I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day that began a strike of lumber workers across the Pacific Northwest. Lumbermen had enough of long hours, dangerous working conditions, and low pay. Plans for the strike began at a meeting of the Sawmill and Timber Workers Union in late March. The union put together a list of demands. They wanted uniform working conditions and pay across the lumber industry and the right of union recognition. They called for a walkout on this day in labor history if progress toward these goals was not being met. Word of the impending strike began to spread in the local press. Since newspapers relied on the paper created by the industry, they closely followed the developments of the work action. Lumber company owners threatened to shut down operations before they would agree to recognize the union. Some workers, fed up with the pace of the negotiations, went on strike before the planned day. Workers at the Bloedel Donovan plant in Bellingham, Washington, walked off the job. Once the strike was in full swing, 30 to 40,000 workers had joined them. 90% of the Northwestern lumber industry was impacted by the strike. As the strike wore on, angry owners called in the National Guard to help bring scabs to get the lumber mills back up and running. In Humboldt County in Northern California, 3 strikers were killed. On June 24th, strikers and troops clashed in what became known as the Battle of Tacoma, Washington. Troops used tear gas to disperse the picketers. In the end, the lumbermen won improvements in wages and hours, but the union did not win a standard agreement across the industry. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So today I'm going to wrap the program up with something a little personal. As you know, I'm a strong supporter of workers organizing to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities, power in the workplace. I believe labor unions are the best way to achieve freedom, economic freedom, social justice, equality. And I've been doing this for almost 19 years now on radio and television. And to my core, and I've said this numerous times, I believe the best way forward, the way working people are come together, is the best possible outcome for us as a country. I believe we're stronger, when we're united. I have carried a union card in my wallet for 35 years now and do still to this day. And I'm proud of my union and have for, you know, those 19 years on air, shared that pride. And over those years, look, like anything, I've had disagreements. I've had dust ups with union leaders or politicians, or I've had problems with people over the years. You do this long enough, you're going to upset someone. You're going to step on some toes. You're going to need to come back and reevaluate. And recently I had, let's call it an encounter, with Teamsters President Sean O'Brien. It seems President O'Brien has taken offense to my disagreeing with his platforming Donald Trump, and in front of a crowd of Teamster leaders at a cocktail party here in Pennsylvania, was quite vocal about that, disagreement. I approached him in the hopes of getting Teamster voices to come on this program and talk about all of the incredible things my fellow Teamsters are doing to make lives better. The organizing on the ground, the legislative work that's being done, the community organizing that's being done, all of the things that are being done to make lives better. President O'Brien, long story short, informed me that the only way I was going to have a relationship with my union of 35 years was to come on air and apologize. It seems he thinks I was talking, let's use the word smack. We all know what S word was actually used, but for the FCC, we'll use smack. So I'm here to apologize for if he thinks I was talking smack. But before I get into to that, I think it's important to understand the context. Have I talked smack about President O'Brien? In the world I grew up, talking smack meant you were lying. You were making something up or just generally being dishonest or saying things that weren't true. The other part of talking smack was doing it behind someone's back. Now, the reality is anything I've said about anyone, done right here, clearly not behind anyone's back. I personally, fundamentally believe platforming a wannabe dictator is wrong. And I spoke about that. I spoke about the Teamsters president's pilgrimage to Mar-a-Lago being a stupid thing to do, allowing Trump to use thunder and lightning, the horses, as a backdrop for Trump to rant about E. Jean Carroll. Thought that was a bad idea. Playing footsie with Trump is a bad idea. I viscerally disagree with these decisions and said so. Is that talking smack? Not in my world. That's called a disagreement. And on this point, we fundamentally disagree. It's one of the things that I love about workplace democracy, about unions, is we can disagree on things and still work together to make workers' lives better. That should be the focus. But truth be told, the O'Brien administration has been hostile towards us from the very start. They don't support this program and they don't respond for guest requests. And this predates the talking smack accusation. In fact, I did reach out to get President O'Brien on this program to talk about why you would go to Mar-a-Lago, why you would platform Trump. Maybe there's something I don't know. And he said, you don't have all the information. And I agree, I don't have all the information. And for that, I apologize. But how much information do I need to not want to platform a wannabe dictator? Let me reiterate this, because I think it's important. I want to talk about the amazing things my union is doing. I would prefer to be talking about the Costco rally in Norfolk, Virginia that just happened, and those workers fight to organize and mobilize. But it appears in order to do that, I have to apologize. And I am sorry. As I said, if I offended President O'Brien, I'm sorry. But I don't apologize for speaking the truth. What I don't do is blind loyalty. I'm never going to be 100% loyal to Sean O'Brien or any labor leader. I don't even agree with myself 100% of the time. That said, I do agree with Sean O'Brien of 2018, where he wrote on his Facebook page after Trump's State of the Union address, "We refuse to remain silent as Trump dismantles all we've fought for. Real Teamsters aren't scared to speak up, and they aren't scared of a fight. Well, I am a real Teamster who's not afraid of a fight. I'm not afraid to fight for my union, not afraid to fight for my country. Donald Trump is a clear and present danger to our democracy and everything we've fought for. There's nothing truer than that. And while I wholeheartedly agree with Sean O'Brien's statement, make no mistake, Trump is our enemy. We must take our partisan emotions out of it and look at the actions of a man, of the man. That's exactly what I did. That said, I apologize if President O'Brien was offended. And whether or not President O'Brien accepts my apology, I can't say. I guess we'll see in the coming weeks and months. I guess if we see him on this program, I guess we'll know. That said, regardless, he is always welcome here. My fellow Teamster brothers and sisters, always welcome here to share their amazing work. Always welcome to come and share their incredible passion for making lives better. Look, I love my union. And will continue to fight for my union brothers and sisters. And with that said, I say goodbye. We will see where this goes. Thank you for taking a moment for me and indulging me. I appreciate it. If you missed any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcast. You'll find ours, thericksmithshow.com, good place to get that. Also, the video component, freespeech.org, always there for you. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.